So, welcome to Food Conversations Season 3. Food Conversations is a program about food in all its aspects, from planting seeds to growing, harvesting, distributing, and eating, with a special emphasis on establishing food sovereignty in the Shoe Swap. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the Shoe Swap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. Before we continue, I'd like to acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkwepmek people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility. Now, you notice we didn't have our theme music starting off today, which is a bit of a signal that today's program is going to be a little different from the average. We had a guest planned today, Samantha Gambling, who is the BC chapter coordinator for the BC Coalition for Healthy Food School Food, which is under the aegis of the Public Health Association of BC. Unfortunately, she's come down with an upper respiratory infection. It may be part of our pandemic or it may not, but she wasn't able to join us today. So we're going to do things a little bit differently. But to whet your appetite for the kind of material Sam is going to be talking about, her focus is on school food, and some of the stats that would tell you why this is an important subject are the following. 1 out of 10 children in this province is experiencing genuine food insecurity. That's, and I'll define that as we go along in the show later on, what food insecurity actually means. And only about 15% of children eat enough fresh fruit and vegetables in this province. In addition, in the school system itself, fewer than 2 out of every 5 children actually get 3 meals a day on school days. So there's some things that we'll be talking about with Sam when she comes on the show, and we hope you'll listen for a future program where we'll have her describing the work she does. But today, we've plugged in a guest who's been on the show a number of times before and who is an active core member of the Shoe Swap Food Action Society. She's the secretary, and that's Melanie Bennett, who has got some news for us about what's happened recently with the Food Action Society. And I'm going to welcome you, Melanie Bennett. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
Delighted to have you with us again. Now, we have some really positive news, and I can attest to it because I was part of the event that we're going to report on first, and that is the Coldest Night of the Year event, which took place last Saturday, the 26th of February, and was, by everything I've heard, an outstanding success. Melanie, why don't you brief us on the Coldest Night of the Year?
Absolutely. Yeah, we're really proud of the fact that we were able to host this community building event. And that was sort of the sentiment when you were there. There were so many smiles. Everybody was visiting. It felt really positive. And you could just sense that people really needed it. So, you know, there's a lot of lead up that goes to Coldest Night of the Year because really it's an online fundraiser. You know, you have these people who decide they really support you. You know, these core team captains. They love us.
Melanie, when do you start organizing? When do you start this year's event? How far in the previous months?
We're contacted, you know, in October. You know, are you still doing it? Yes, sign the contract. So yes, you're doing it. And then, you know, you just kind of keep plugging away a little bit. I actually started a little bit late this year, I got to be honest. I think the last few years really took its toll on me, and I felt pretty tired all the way through Christmas. And it took me a while to really get my engines running again. But once you start remembering, like, what it's for, what is this for, why are we here, you get going. And so, you know, the biggest push starts right there at the beginning of January. January 1st, it's a new year, 2022, the year of solutions. And we get going and you begin reaching out, number one, to sponsors.
Indeed. So why don't you lay out some of the sponsors who really make it a community event?
They do, because, you know, they start the goal going, and they when you have sponsors to an event, it makes it feel like legitimate. I don't know if that's really the right
word. It's not just you, it's a whole bunch of other people as well.
Yeah, it's like, you know, there's some backing to this. It's real. It's and so we, of course, approached the people that all the businesses that supported us last year. And, you know, who better to support us than our sort of core supporters, Askew's and Saskew. So Askew's, you know, they're absolutely integral to our local food economy. You know, there's not a lot of independent grocers anymore, and they're doing really well. So Askew's absolutely, and Saskew, I mean, the two of them being in such close proximity, they work in conjunction often, and the Saskew also supports our farmers market. So the two of them, absolutely, hands up, for sure, we will support you.
And we started off, as I recall very well, in the parking lot of the Salmon Arm Savings and Credit Union, with a little speech from you and a few other people, including David Askew. And then we ended up in front of Askew's downtown, consuming stone soup. You gotta tell people what stone soup is, because I didn't find a single stone. I've sometimes found stones in lentils, and there were lentils in it, but I didn't find any in this soup. Tell us about the stone soup saga.
So stone soup is a beautiful story that's been told a long time, and there's different versions of it. But really what it comes down to is it's about sharing, and it's about bringing a community together. And the idea is that when we all share, the soup gets richer and more tasty. And so we were really happy to be able to use the Zest Food Kitchen. Mm. So Serena was in charge of soup because she's been making a lot of soup. With all of the food programs that she's doing, she's been tailoring all these recipes up to be able to accommodate many people. And she also really wanted to be able to challenge some of our schools, our school PACs, those parent advisory committees. She wanted them to be able to participate in this event and provide them with a free hot lunch. So the Food Action Society, we bought all the ingredients for the soup, provided it to the school with the recipe. We gave the story to the teachers so that they could, you know, in advance teach these kids about this concept. Mm-hmm. And we allowed them to really take it. And it was an overwhelming success. The students loved it. The parents really enjoyed being involved. And
so there was more than there was. Serena got a team together to help prepare the material, the food.
For the coldest night?
Yeah.
I don't actually know if she ended up having any helpers. She's so adept at this point. She went and rented the Zest, and she got her soup going, and she cooked her big batches of stone soup, which is really a vegetable lentil. I mean, it's whatever you want it to be. Mm-hmm. In this case, we chose lentils from Fieldstone Organics, and it was a very delicious soup, and everybody loved it.
Yeah, I had three bowls myself.
Hey, good for you.
I could have had more, too. And you served it in front of Askew's downtown, right on the sidewalk there, in a special little enclosure created. It really seemed to flow very smoothly. That part of it seemed to really, the soup flowed smoothly.
That's great.
Yeah. So it was also a fundraising event. This is not, this is a working joy form of joy. How did that go, the fundraising side?
Well, it's very exciting. I mean, we got 99% of our goal. We just about reached it. You know, last year we exceeded our goal by a lot. And so we were overwhelmed. We set our goal a little higher this year. You never know what's going to happen. It took a little while. It always comes in those last few weeks. But we were just really excited to watch it climb, and 99%, which ends up being a little under $60,000.
Money that will be well used, I'm quite sure. Now, you had teams. You had teams, all sorts of teams, from every walk of life, you might say. How many teams, and what were some of the fanciful names, if you remember any of them?
So there was 37 teams.
Lordy.
And as I was mentioning, like, the teams are really a big, big part of it, because these are people who really believe in what you're doing. And these are active people. You know, they're people who want to do. And so what they do is they gather their friends, families, colleagues, and they say, come do this with me. This is why this is important. Let's fundraise together. So they are sort of like the backbone to this event. You know, we had the Royal LePage team, I mean, they did amazing. They had so much support. They had 11 members, and they raised, I think, close to $5,000. You know, we had the Saskew Community Crew. They walk every year. We had the Sophia Sisters. I love their story. This is a group of 12 people who, it's a supportive group of women who in the last 2 years especially have just been making sure that they are looking out for one another. We had the Broadview Church came back, and, you know, we had Purple Penguins. This was a group of young women who, like, I'm talking, I think maybe 15, 16 years old, who decided to do this, which was nice because we really do need to see more youth involved.
So do you have in-kind contributions or is it mostly cash? You have in-kind contributions?
We have a lot of in-kind contributions, which we're so grateful for. You know, Crystal Burr just decided she would become our photographer again this year, which is really important because good photos go a long way.
They do.
But, you know, we had DeMille's. They offered everyone fruit at the event. So, I mean, we're an advocate for local food. So all of the food that we, and snacks and drinks, everything that we provided for the event, it had to be local as possible, if not BC. I mean, we had Wise Tea as a drink option. And that's from the coast, but it's BC. Sure. And then we had these little farming karma apple drinks, you know, and those are from the Okanagan apples. But locally, like Shuswap Coffee provided coffee. We had Inspired Breads provided the buns for the meal. And Little Red Hen, you know, treats at this rest stop. So it's amazing how much the community came together.
I'm getting hungry. I'm sorry to say I'm getting hungry, but I'll quell my appetite for now.
You must have had one of those Little Red Hen squares.
To be honest, what I had was a Saskew cookie.
Okay. Well,
it looked a little bit like a dog bone with Saskew.
They were tasty. Hand-piped. Each one of those cookies was hand-piped. And we got those made at Uptown Askew's.
I'll be darned. Yeah, it was a very joyful event, social event. The thing about walking in a crew is, you know, that you have an opportunity to talk to people. And because you're doing something that's a community event, you talk about community events. And I walked much of the distance with Jaron Kaner, Sunya Kaner's husband, and we covered a lot of territory verbally as well as physically, and then had an opportunity to connect with Claire Askew, David's daughter, and we caught up in some events that she's involved with. So all in all, it was, from my point of view as a participant, and I'm sure from yours as an organizer, it was a very satisfying thing to be involved with. Now, there's just a couple of things you might talk about, some of the other projects that the Food Action Society is engaged in, because it's shaping up to be a busy year. And a couple of things are going to be really developing in being fleshed out. One of them is the food forest on the grounds of the Salvation Army. It's already visible. You can see the beginnings of it. How's that coming along? Kelly Westgate is, of course, the prime mover in terms of the work and organizing.
She's incredible. I mean, she has everything so well organized. She's got all the plans in place. So we're really grateful that she came. It's really interesting how people come into your spectrum, your viewpoint. Mm-hmm. She did, and it's worked out so well.
Yeah,
I think it's coming along, and we have some proposed dates for some of the installations of the food forest.
I understand also that you're moving the teaching garden into you're establishing a new,
not moving it,
but a new part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So this one is actually more going to be a traditional community garden where we want to build plots, raised beds for people to grow their own food.
Wonderful. So Melanie, the teaching garden, which has been in place on 30th Street for a long time, that's the main location still, right? And it's going to be moving forward as it has for a number of years. What kind of plans do you have on the teaching side?
So yeah, these are two different garden projects, and we want to maintain the Shoeshop Community Teaching Garden, which is in North Broadview, as a place of teaching. But it's about production. It's about, and especially this year, our focus is grow as much food as we possibly can on that space, with the knowledge that more people are accessing the food banks than before, that more people need good quality food. And we want to make sure that that land is well used. We still have permission by the owners to keep it going. This is its seventh growing season. A lot of work has gone into that land. And so it's very important that we keep this project going, for sure.
Workshops, seminars, teaching events, what's in line in that department?
So, you know, I just want to acknowledge why the Coldest Night is so important. Those funds help us keep these projects going. And the teaching, kind of last year, we didn't do as much teaching. There was various reasons why. But this year, this fundraiser really helps keep things going, the funds. So with these funds, we have more time, more ability to keep pushing the teaching aspect. And in our case, I'm working with a lady named Sue Moore, incredible knowledge base. She used to grow her own food out in Tappan, 14 acres of organic vegetables to sell. And under her tutelage, we're going to max out that garden. So
Sue regularly brought her seedlings to the organic market outside Askew's Uptown. And I've been to her farm. It was a lot of work, and it was not surprising that she eventually moved away from the farming world. But she has such a wealth of knowledge that
wants to share it.
Yes, indeed.
And thank goodness, because she's now already taught. Last weekend, we've had our very first gardening 101. You know, just the basics to understanding how to grow vegetables predominantly, and it was so popular that we had to have a wait list. And because of that wait list, we're offering another class this Sunday at Pedro's, and it's full. but yeah, so now we've had two classes under her care. And so, everybody says absolutely fantastic. And so she and I were working on a calendar of different classes. We want to have at least two classes a month. And if we can have them up at the community teaching garden, we'll do that for sure. And otherwise, we really want to work. The Food Action Society, we want to work with all the other businesses too. We are collaborators. So we've done it with Pedro's. We want to work with Nico's, work with Buckerfield's. Like, whoever can host, we're going to be there. And we're going to teach just all aspects of growing food, so that as people start this journey, because it really is, it is work. It doesn't have to be hard work if you get the knowledge first. If you can get good instruction, it makes it more successful that first time around.
Do you sense by any chance a qualitative difference in this level of interest that you're seeing this year? I mean, I know you now have an experienced professor of gardening to teach them. But you said you're oversubscribed 5 years ago, 3 years ago. Would you have seen this same level of interest? Do you sense that there's a growing mood, if you like, in the community?
So a quantitative difference. Absolutely. I mean, the pandemic, it showed us that was... Our systems are fragile. We've discussed this before. We can see it now. It's there, and people can sense that. And certainly in 2020, there was a little bit of empty shelves. People just got the sense, maybe it's time to put in a garden. And certainly more people in 2020 put in a garden, and even more in 2021, because then we saw things like supply shortages too. Everything was bought off the shelves. And this year, we know with food prices are going up, we know that with, highways being washed out, we saw just how fragile we are here. With everything that happened in the summer, we know that farmers' crops were affected last year, affecting supply. It's just so much more apparent now. There's no getting around it anymore. We need to be proactive. And I think people get that sense.
I'm just going to put out a couple of definitions, which we can talk about. They're definitions of food security and food sovereignty. They're related, but they're not the same. So food security is generally defined as something along the lines of the availability of food and the measure of individuals' ability to access it. It means that there is food available to people, all people, at all times, and that they have physical, social, and economic access to sufficient, safe, and nutritious food that meets their food preferences and dietary needs for an active, healthy and active lifestyle. Now, food sovereignty is along the same lines, with a difference that the local population isn't just producing, is not just having access to food, but also is producing and distributing it and has some control over the mechanisms and policies for food production and distribution. In other words, there's some measure of saying, we want this kind of food, we want it fresh, and we want it to be grown in a certain way. That's what seems to be the outcome of what you're talking about, this new interest. Maybe part of it is just saving money, because if you grow your own food, then you don't have to, Mother Nature doesn't charge for the content of her seeds and her other sources of food. So that's sort of what you're seeing, it's leading towards food security and food sovereignty as people are motivated by what they see. Is that about right?
Yes. I mean, food security, we know very well that with the cost of life right now, people aren't, I mean, when you say food security, people might be able to have food. They might have boxes of things. They might have cans of things in their cupboards, but they don't have necessarily nutritious food. That fresh produce that is so important for health. And so we may have enough food, but we don't have true food security. That, you know, like you said, to be able to have a healthy and active lifestyle. And that's what we hope with these community gardens, people growing more of their own food for themselves, but also enough to share, because that will be very important. Then they have food security. Food sovereignty is the ideal to aspire to. And that's we say food secure shoe shop, and we could say food sovereign shoe shop. It's a beautiful aspiration to say we can provide for ourselves right now, right here, when we need to.
In preparing for this show, because the regular guest we had planned wasn't here, so I was scrubbing around looking at a whole range of definitions of food and where it comes from. And it's quite clear that the food system that we have relied on for about, let's say, roughly 40 to 50 years, and that is the corporate food sourcing process and the distribution of markets around the world, we haven't really appreciated how vulnerable and, as you say, fragile that system is to disruption on the one hand, and on the other hand, how it relies on vast consumption of fossil fuels, which we are increasingly aware is the prime driver of the climate crisis. So it almost seems like two issues are being solved at the same time. One is the availability of healthy, safe, secure foods is becoming central in people's thinking and ways to make that happen. And the second is really rejigging the entire food system back to, really, to be honest, back to where it was prior to about 50 years ago. Most food was locally grown. Most consumption of food was by people who knew the person who was growing the food that they were eating. So as an observer, the Food Action Society is fairly centrally located in this discourse and this process. What does it feel like to be watching this taking place around you, Melanie, as you live in this wonderful part of the world?
Well, it's bittersweet. I mean, I I'm such a proponent of gardening. I love gardening. It's just such a miraculous thing. So I'm so excited for people to be coming back to this. I think it's just so important and so fulfilling. And I hope that people will learn that joy. So it's bittersweet because you don't want things to collapse because it's going to be tough and it'll be uncomfortable. But unfortunately, human beings often need a bit of a nudge. And, you know, so much of what's happened in the last many years is because we gave away a lot of our power to make choices about our food to big corporations because they made it seem like it was going to be really great and you're going to have all this extra time and there's going to be so much abundance and it's just going to be wonderful. And it was this really false novelty that they sold to us. And it's time to look at that really hard and say, no, it's not doing us any good. We're not any healthier. We don't have more time necessarily. And let's just get back to the basics. What works? What are our basic needs? And food is certainly one of them.
One of the sweet parts of this process would seem to me, the thing you started off this comment with, and that is getting in touch with the entirely miraculous, sort of incomprehensible and yet magical process of growing things and being surrounded by things that are growing. Our 400,000 years of human identifiable human culture has been embedded in natural ecosystems. And we've kind of played a game of thinking we didn't need that. And now, not just for food, but for our own sort of, you could call it spiritual nourishment, our own sense of emotional security as well, getting back into the natural world and fostering the natural world so that it is everywhere and in among the human community in every way seems to be also part of what's happening right now.
Yeah, and you know, regenerative agriculture, permaculture, grazing, I mean, there's lots of words being coming around again. It's getting back to how nature does things. Nature has been around a lot longer. Nature is awfully smart, and we have so much we can learn from her, and just utilize it. And that's why we really love, you know, permaculture techniques. The food forest is going to be mimicking so much of that. You know, with the community gardens, we're going to be doing very traditional kind of, like we're doing rows with drip irrigation, but we amend with compost. We're not tilling. We want that soil to be healthy and rich with all of the little mycorrhizae. And, you know, we're going to do compost tea fertilizers. We want to use nature's best to help us grow really nutrient dense food.
Well, I think we're well on our way on that journey. It seems to me that we're starting to really head back into the world of Mother Nature, where we really belong and where our aspirations could be most readily fulfilled. Melanie, I want to thank you very much for being on the show today on such short notice, but with so many things to add to what Food Conversations is all about.
One thing in.
Go for it, Melanie.
If anybody wants to be a part of any of these garden projects, please email me, melanie@projects@shushwapfood.ca. We'll get you on an email list. We'll let you know everything that's happening.
Do you want to say that email again? I heard two @s, and I want to make sure that that's correct.
projects@shushwapfood.ca.
There we are. projects@shushwapfood.ca. You heard it here on Food Conversations from Melanie Bennett, the Secretary of the Shushwap Food Action Society. Melanie, it's delightful to have you on the show again. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Warren. Bye-bye.
Now today, as listeners who've been with us from the beginning of the show will know, is a bit different because the guest we had planned here wasn't able to turn up, but Melanie Bennett, who just signed off, has supplied us with a very fulsome and valuable update on the workings of the Shushwap Food Action Society. In our conversation, Melanie and I talked about a number of concepts that I think today I thought we could I could lay out some of the concepts, because there's a lot of new, old, interlocking concepts around food, both growing it and distributing it and consuming it, that are very relevant to what this program is all about. Food Conversations' ultimate goal is fostering food sovereignty in the Shoe Swap. So I did a little homework last night, and I looked up a number of these definitions, and I'm going to lay them out for you, and you'll see how interrelated they are. Melanie and I talked about food security. Food security is a pretty basic concept. It means that there is food available for all the people all the time, and that it's food that is safe and nutritious, and it's the kind of food that they'd like to eat. So it satisfies food preferences and of course dietary needs, and allows people to live active and healthy lives. Now, food sovereignty is an extension of that, as we noted earlier. And in this case, there is control over the food system, and the people who produce and distribute and consume food also have control over how this happens, over the various mechanisms to make it happen, and over the policies that control food production and the food regime in general. Now, we have, for about 40 or 50 years, relied on a system that involves producing food under the control of corporate players, often very large corporate players, companies like Archer Midland Daniels and Monsanto and Bayer, or Bayer, as they say in Germany. And they have decided that the best way to produce food is to find the cheapest place to grow it, meaning labor costs are low and various kinds of inputs are inexpensive, and then take it to places where people can afford to pay a lot of money for that food. And they do, and that's us in our part of the world. And the profits go to those large corporations. And it's been a very good business model for the corporate sector. However, it hasn't been a very good model for communities like ours, because increasingly those very, very long lines of distribution, up to 10,000 or 15,000 kilometers long, have been very vulnerable to disruptions. And they are increasingly disrupted these days by what are called extreme weather events. And what are the extreme weather events caused by? Well, they're caused by a changing climate. And who is responsible for that? Well, it turns out it's us. And our influence and sometimes interference with the what you might call the metabolism of planet Earth has increasingly disrupted that metabolism and resulted in things like heat domes, like wildfires, like floods and debris flows, and rivers of rain falling from the sky, tornadoes and various kinds of other wind storms that have been mightily disruptive of all sorts of, not only supply lines, but individual human lives all over the world. And they're going to be continuing until we wrestle our influence on the planet's behavior to the ground. Right now, we're just beginning to understand how important that is. Now, it's probably useful to know that food security is not something that has just happened in one part of the world, or is something people are concerned about in one part of the world. In Canada, there's actually an organization called Food Secure Canada, which began in the minds of a number of participants at an event that took place at Ryerson Polytechnic University in Toronto back in 2001. So two decades ago, there was concern about food security in this country. And the title of the conference was Working Together, Civil Society Input for Food Security in Canada. And the people who were there represented all aspects of society, and they all had the same concern. And that is, how do you make sure that the food supply is available to everybody in the way I've described it earlier? Everybody, all the time, and it's safe, and it's healthy, and it leads to healthy lives. Well, that conference led to a process that about 5 years later, in 2006, resulted in the formation of the organization called Food Secure Canada, which has representatives from all of the country and networks in every province and territory, all aimed towards developing the country's commitment to food security, both within the boundaries of the country and elsewhere as well. Now, there are risks to food sovereignty. One of the risks, and security, one of the risks is just how many of us there are on the planet. Every person born has to eat and drink and do a few other things like breathing air. But with respect to food, each one of us is a necessary consumer of food resources. Now, there are those who believe that with technology, we can simply find new ways to grow. And we are, and we will. But the burden on the planet and its resources increases as our population increases. Right now, just to give you an example, the weight of humans and our domestic animals is far greater than all the wildlife on the planet, all the mammalian wildlife. So the tigers, the lions, the wildebeests, the wild rodents of one sort, and that's like sea otters, the primates, all of the wild animals on the planet used to be the dominant, the volume, if you like, of wildlife and animals. Now we have supplanted them. We and our domestic animals are the dominant form of living creatures, animal creatures on the planet. And that's a change that's taken place in the last 100 years. So we've actually, with our needs as humans, taken over the systems of the earth in order to supply us, ourselves. Now, that the other risk, of course, is the changing climate. We are changing the climate. Humans are changing it. And as we do so, we make not only our food systems, but our very existence and future existence we put it in jeopardy. And the way that is happening, of course, is that the weather disturbances I was describing earlier are progressing and becoming more intense. And various other things are happening. There's a huge glacier in Antarctica called the Thwaites Glacier, which is being undermined by seawater, which, because of the pressure of the ice above, can actually stay liquid at below freezing temperatures, is about -3 degrees Celsius, this seawater. But it's underlying a huge glacier, so huge that were it to break off, and there are scientists now studying this glacier as we speak, were it to break off, its volume alone would raise the level of sea water by about 85 centimeters. The entire glacier is so huge that were it to melt in the ocean, there would be an increase in sea level of about 85 centimeters, which is pretty substantial. It's getting up to a meter in height. If you throw in the effects of sea storms, storms that whip up the ocean and propel it towards land with wave action, it's going to inundate, for example, with respect to Vancouver, approximately 30% of the land area of Vancouver and the associated areas of the Lower Mainland. And it could happen within anywhere from a year to 10 years, maybe 15 years. So it's something coming down the pike directly at us, and it's not going to make life easier for us. So we're definitely facing some major issues that we're going to have to deal with, and they're not going to go away. Now, this is leading us to some general considerations, and one of them is a term that everybody's probably heard, and it's the term ecology. Now, that word wasn't used widely in scientific or common speech until several decades ago, probably not more than 40 or 50 years. And what it is a study of our home. Now, it comes from two Greek words. One is oikos, which means house, and logia, which means study, the study of. And it's a study of the relationships between living organisms, including humans, and their physical environment. So it considers organisms, living things, at various levels. There's the individual organism, there's a population of organisms, there's a community of organisms, which are all part of the same geographical area. There are ecosystems, and then there's the entire planetary ecosystem, which is called the biosphere. Now, it may be interesting to people to realize that studying this is only about a half century old in terms of really, really putting scientific effort into doing that kind of work. And the terminology that is new is a reflection of that. We're using different terms that give us a sense of our home, our living home, and the physical home that we live in terms of the physical elements like water, land, and air. But that we're, as we start to study that more, we really start to realize how deep the jeopardy is that we are facing and how important it is for us to come up with solutions. I'm just going to run through a few more definitions related to food that are all pretty much recent, and they're all relevant to achieving food sovereignty. I just talked to you a little bit about the word ecology. Now, there's another term related to that called agroecology. And what that refers to is introducing basic processes that work in live, wild ecosystems into the way we grow our food. So it's a study of the relationship between living organisms, including humans, and our physical environment. It includes, for example, the interactions between plants, animals, humans, and the environment within agricultural systems. So it accepts the fact that what we grow for food is an integral part of the world around us. It's not something that we do separately from the world of Mother Nature. And that leads to a form of agriculture that we touched briefly on when I was talking with Melanie, and that is regenerative agriculture. Now, it's different from our kind of conventional agriculture, which is often focused on maximizing production at the expense of everything else. Regenerative agriculture is more a conservation and rehabilitation approach to food and farming systems. Its emphasis is on regenerating the soil, increasing biodiversity, so increasing the number of species that are growing and flourishing within the system in which we grow food, improving the water cycle, meaning that we plant in such a way that it conserves water in the land and increases the availability of water in growing. And it also enhances ecosystem services. Now, what are ecosystem services? That's what Mother Nature does for us without charging us. She simply has processes that make our lives better by the way she structures the plants and animals around us in the landforms that we live in. It also increases resilience to climate change because it does trap water in the soil and keep it there where it belongs instead of putting it up in the sky where it falls down on our heads in these famous rivers in the sky. So that's regenerative agriculture. What is one of the underpinnings of regenerative agriculture? It's soil health. Soil health is how you grow healthy food. If you don't have healthy soil, your food is going to be depleted and inadequate in some way. And soil is not just dirt. Soil is a material that performs a range of ecosystem functions. It's filled with a whole range of living components, which we're only starting to fully appreciate. Everybody knows about compost. Well, compost is where you take all the food you're not eating and cuttings and leaves and stuff, and you put it together and you let Mother Nature work her magic on it. Well, that is one of the ways that soil health is increased. And when you put compost into the soil and then you stop digging it up with plows and harrows and various other instruments, you actually get a process that Mother Nature is in control of, and the health of the soil is hugely enhanced. Now, one of the forms in which soil health is a primary concern, and again, we talked about it, Melanie and I talked about it briefly, is the notion of permaculture. Now, permaculture is actually, it's a mashup. It's a mashup of two words, permanent and culture. And it refers to the fact that when you plant, you don't plant one season's crop, harvest it, dig up the soil, put some stuff in the soil, and then start all over again the next year. You put together a range of plant and animal life, and you carefully do it using Mother Nature's processes, but human ingenuity as well, so that the planting of this area is there for all time. It is able to regenerate itself, and it works according to our needs, but also it follows the principles of Mother Nature. So it's an approach to land management and even designing our settlements that adopts arrangements observed in flourishing natural ecosystems. We take those arrangements and we modify them modestly, and then we use them for our purposes, but also the purposes of Mother Nature. Now, ironically, much of what we are doing today in this way is a return to what many people would call traditional knowledge. Now, Indigenous peoples all over the world have had a deep knowledge, a very sophisticated knowledge of the ecosystem systems in which they live. And traditional knowledge is that base of sophisticated understanding of the natural world. Now, it's been defined as a cumulative body of knowledge, know-how, practices, and representations maintained and developed by peoples with extended histories of interaction with the natural environment. For many, many decades, the countries that we would consider colonial powers have ridden roughshod over this body of knowledge and the people who have gathered it in over centuries and, in fact, millennia. We have assumed that our technical capabilities, putting things together, would somehow kind of act as a superior way of doing things. We know that that's wrong, and we're now starting to understand it. And I want, as I close out my remarks, to just tell you that the food forest that is being built in Salmon Arm is part of that return to an understanding of Indigenous processes and Indigenous knowledge and traditional knowledge, and it will be a return to an ancient way of securing food that has happened all around the world, probably the oldest form of land use and the absolutely most resilient form of agriculture and agro-ecosystem, if you want to call it. And we're going to see that happening more and more around the world and in our area as well. And it's going to make this place a food secure part of the world. So I'm just to close with a few remarks about where we're going with respect to changing the landscape, both figuratively and literally. We're returning to ways of growing foods that enhance our ability to eat. It's pure and simple. But it's doing it, we're doing it by returning to ways that have been used for thousands and thousands of years. The notion of a forest as a garden, if you like, has been with us as far as we can look back and measure. There's evidence for what you could call a forest garden all over the world and in all continents and climates. For example, in the southeastern United States, the food forests growing nut trees supplied Indigenous communities with more nutritious food than any other form of agriculture has produced in the time since then. So we're all facing a kind of change of heart. Our change of heart is towards understanding that we aren't the generation that changed everything for the better. We're a generation that is changing as every previous generation has the world around us. But we have to go back to some patterns that have been around for far longer than human society has existed. And they are the patterns that Mother Nature has developed and has made available to us freely, which we, by adapting to and following, will prosper and do very well. In the meantime, this show and many others will be talking about how to make that happen. And over time, we hope that this show won't be necessary because everybody will be adopting the principles that we've laid out for you. So thank you once again for listening to Food Conversations.